FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled The Fundamental Contradiction Between the Knowledge Society and the Knowledge Economy. This talk is delivered by Professor David Livingstone.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. It gives me great pleasure to welcome you to the penultimate of this year's Work in Progress seminar series, better known as WIPS. Tonight, we are very fortunate to have as our speaker Professor David Livingstone. David is Canada Research Chair in Lifelong Learning and Work at the University of Toronto and Professor Emeritus in the Department of Humanities, Social Sciences, and Social Justice Education at the Ontario Institute for Studies in Education, WASI, of University of Toronto. He became internationally renowned through two books, Class Ideologies and Educational Futures, and thereafter, Education and Jobs, Underemployment and Economic Democracy. Most recently, David has written Education and Jobs, Exploring the Gap, that's University of Toronto Press, 2009, Lifelong Learning in Paid and Unpaid Work, Routledge, 2010, Manufacturing Meltdown, Reshaping Steelwork, with David Smith and William Smith, Fernwood, 2011, The Knowledge Economy and Lifelong Learning, A Critical Reader, edited by Sense Publishers, 2012. He will be speaking to the topic, The Fundamental Contradiction Between the Knowledge Society and the Knowledge Economy, Marx's Relevance Today. David, welcome.
I have to begin by making one minor correction on the introduction. Dorothy Smith would never want to be introduced as a man, for any of you who know her work. Okay, let me begin by thanking you for the invitation and indicating that my presentation discussing the relationship between knowledge economy and knowledge society will be based primarily on my experience and documentation of the Canadian case. Its relevance to the Maltese I leave to you, except to observe that Malta is also definitely part of the advanced capitalist economy cluster. But beyond that, I leave it to your reflection as to whether the findings that I will present to you or the argument have resonance with this society as well. Procedurally, number one, I would ask you to interrupt me if I'm making some points that are obscure to you, if you want a clarification. I will try to leave ample time at the end for discussion so that we can engage with some of these points. And I will try, in deference to the podcast, to be a little more explicit to people who don't have the benefit of the PowerPoint graphs on the board. So let me begin with a couple of social facts. On the left-hand side here, we have a portrayal of the growth of the Internet. In 1995, there were roughly 16 million people in the world who were engaged with on the Internet. As of next month, a few days from now, the estimate is 3 billion. This is one of the most exponential growths of any kind of technology diffusion that has ever occurred in the history of the world. So there is massive explosion of the availability of information through new means which are accessible to more and more people. We can see this as a manifestation of what I would call the socialization of knowledge. Extraordinary growth, explosive growth, affecting all of our lives. Virtually everybody in this room is engaging with knowledge in a very different way than you did in 1995, precisely because of the availability, this greater accessibility of more and more forms of information, some of which was only privately available at that point. Various kinds of patents on information have been released and made more available to more people. So more and more people learning more and more stuff about more and more things. Conversely, on the other side of the equation, and this is reflective more of the knowledge economy than the knowledge society, we have a portrayal, not a very graphically clear one, I admit, but the first mapping that has ever occurred since the development of transnational corporations, of their concentration and centralization in recent times. Study done by Professor Vitali and his colleagues at the Swiss Institute of Science and Technology. Based on 2007 data, 43,000 plus corporations, transnational corporations, tracing the control and power structures of the networks that they're involved in. And they find that there are 50 of these corporations that effectively control 40% of the assets of all transnational corporations in the world, all 40,000 plus of them. And there are 22 that control the plurality of those. And there's one corporation, just to give you an illustration, and not to name names here, that controls 4% of the assets of all transnational corporations in the world. Would anybody care to venture a guess what that corporation is besides Peter Mayo? What large transnational corporation do you think of in terms of its impact on your lives above all others? Microsoft? Google, yes, okay. So the examples you're giving me are intimately connected with the Internet. They're deliverers of the Internet. They're packaging it, commercializing it various ways. In fact, the 50 top transnational corporations in the world in terms of value are all financial corporations. All financial corporations that control a variety of other corporations that may be in personal services, computers, mining, etc. But these control structures are insidious, and they essentially concentrate and centralize the control and the decision-making power of economic activity increasingly in the world. One that controls 4% is Barclays Bank. And I'll name just a few of the others just to give you a feel for this concentration before we go ahead. I'll give you the top five and see if any of these resonate. Barclays, Capital Group Companies, FMR Corporation, AXA, State Street Corporation, and then J.P. Morgan Chase. That one you might be familiar with, it's American-based. And we go down the list. And all 50 of these are still very, very powerful, with the exception of one, Lehman Brothers. Now, that illustrates the other point I was going to make here, that nothing is constant in this process. This concentration and centralization process that's occurring is very dynamic. But the other point that is important to realize from the research of these Swiss researchers and other colleagues is that the more this system of control and ownership of the capitalist economy becomes concentrated, the more prone to vulnerability, the more prone to shock. The Great Recession of 2008 was effectively promoted and exacerbated, increased by the fact that there could not be as much diversity in response. All of these firms were so interlocked that they were all affected by this process. Some people look at the subprime mortgage crisis in the United States as a catalyzing factor. It was one, but the fact that this concentrated structure was so tightly wound meant that a little bump could tip it significantly so that everybody suffered. The other point that I want to make in relationship to the juxtaposition of these two phenomena, the internet growth and the concentration of transnational capital, is that the concentration of capital is impeding the growth and development of the net. So that we look at the commodification, the commercialization of the net today, and all of the sources that you are now trying to access are becoming bumped up and blocked by some version of commercialization. You have to buy more things on the net, you have more commercials intruding in your use of the net. It was intended initially to be a free socialized device for sharing of knowledge amongst all people. So that's a contradiction that is becoming increasingly evident to us as we live our everyday lives, trying to access information, which is increasingly impeded and intervened upon by commercial profit-making processes. So that takes me then to my basic point in terms of the relationship between a knowledge economy, which is becoming increasingly concentrated in its ownership and control on the one hand, and a knowledge society in which there are more and more opportunities for more and more of us to share and develop forms of real useful knowledge. So let me just back up a little bit here and start with a couple of definitions. The contradiction, as I mentioned briefly, is that there is the need in this capitalist economy for a continual development of workers' knowledge. It's required for profit maximization, increasingly as we have an economy which is oriented toward the development of information commodities as opposed to material commodities. More information and knowledge processing is built into every commodity, which means more intellectual labor. But at the same time, the system is limited in terms of the recognition and reward of this knowledge for fair compensation of the workers, because that can seriously limit capitalist owners' realization of profits against each other. So the competitive process bumps up continually against the needs of working people for recognition and reward of the knowledge they're developing. That's the contradiction that we experience every day in the system in multiple ways, and I'll try to illustrate a few of these as we go ahead. So first, a couple of definitions that I've simply picked off the web. This one, a definition of a knowledge economy from the United Kingdom Department of Trade and Industry. A knowledge economy is one in which the generation and exploitation of knowledge has come to play a predominant part in the creation of wealth. It's not simply about pushing back the frontiers of knowledge, it's also about the most effective use and exploitation of all types of knowledge in all manner of economic activity. Contrast that to the definition of knowledge society, which I picked off Yahoo. A knowledge society is one that creates, shares, and uses knowledge for the prosperity and well-being of its people. Profits versus people. Parenthetical note, I'm waiting for the audience here to read this one rather than writing, saying it to everybody. But it basically repeats what I just said before, podcasters. So, here are a couple of judgments about the current state of play in the world economy. This one is from Warren Buffett, who most of you have probably heard of, the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, one of the major venture capitalist companies in the world. There has been a class warfare going on for the last 20 years, and my class has won. That I would characterize as a fairly smug capitalist view of the situation. And this I would characterize as a democratic fearful one from Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, currently sitting in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, waiting for some sort of asylum or prosecution. The internet, our greatest tool of emancipation, has been transformed into the most dangerous facilitator of totalitarianism we have ever seen, supranational and dominated by global corporate power. These are the conditions as they're perceived by some. I would suggest that this is not an inevitable situation, that redistribution may be a more feasible solution than destitution in the long run. But we can deal with that factor, or discussion of that, as we proceed to the end of the discussion, I hope. in any case, we are not, in my view, at the end of history by any stretch. I think the capitalist mode of production is the most dynamic and change-prone that has ever been on the face of the earth. In contrast to the dominance of neoliberal state regimes, austerity programs, which we see all around us, just consider the potential significance of countermoves toward redistribution rather than destitution, as illustrated in this slide, which suggests that essentially the Greek annual deficit, the debt of Spain, Greece, Ireland, Italy, and Portugal, and a variety of other deficits could be erased by the wealth of a few capitalists. That's simply to suggest if we're rebalancing and redistributing, there's a lot of possibility on the one side and not much on the other side in terms of a sharing exercise. And we can go on to discuss that further, I hope. Now let me just suggest a conceptual frame for thinking about work and learning in a capitalist economy. In ancient times, work and learning were fused. In our times, the emergence of industrial society, we have the separation of paid labor from housework. So the household becomes a separate sphere. We do our paid work in another area. Community volunteer work is something that becomes increasingly something that we do separately as well if we have the time to do it. And of course, we'd have some effort to do leisure activities of self-care, hobbies, and even sleep if we have the time. Those are the forms of activity we engage in, and they become increasingly discernible. In fact, unpaid housework becomes increasingly visible as the vast majority of women go out into paid work, and it has to be juggled, so men and women have to figure out how to do it, rather than presuming the woman's going to do virtually all of it, which was the case 30 years ago. So there's more visibility of these activities now, there's more separability, and secondly, the forms of learning that we engage in are also distinguishable, although they always overlap. So we have formal schooling, the essentially initial lockstep process we go through from kindergarten, elementary school, secondary school, through college or university. And then we have further education, further adult continuing education, which means the kind of activity that we engage in as adults, which is voluntary. We choose to engage in a kind of a classroom setting and usually get some kind of credit for it. This is a quasi further education exercise we're engaged in right now. Thirdly, informal education, which is probably our most important form of education in terms of learning how to do things in life. We all have mentors who have instructed us either incidentally or intentionally about how to do things, from tying our shoelaces, combing our hair, to figuring out how to read another person's everything. And finally, we have self-directed learning, which is the kind of learning that we do either individually or with peers to figure out things by ourselves without a clear mentor. All of those forms of learning are active in our lives continually. But today what we're going to focus on in this discussion, initially at least, are paid employment and relationships with formal schooling and further education. So this is an orienting framework, and I argue that all of these forms of work and learning need to be understood if we're going to understand the fullness of work-learning relations. For example, housework is something we have to learn. Nobody's ever studied it before. Our network studied it in the last several years. And there's a lot of research that we've provided on that now. By the way, I should mention that for findings that I don't have time to get into here, you're welcome to consult the website, which is www.wallnetwork.ca, and there's a vast array of materials there which are available, and I encourage you to consult whenever you can, related to all of the points I'm going to be discussing and beyond, and certainly the ones that are beneath the surface of the paid employment, formal and further learning. So, in short, what I'm going to do is first discuss employment conditions, and then look at learning conditions, and then look at the relations between work and learning conditions briefly, and provide some provisional conclusions based on the Canadian case, and then hopefully open it up for our discussion. This is the website. Again, I'll mention it one more time, particularly for podcasters, www.wallnetwork.ca. There were several research networks that were funded by the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, and I'm bound to encourage you to use these resources because a considerable amount of money was given to us to produce this research for the benefit of the world, and particularly other Canadians. And so I hope some of you may find some of it of some use in the future. Not only three national surveys, 98, 2004, and 2010, but over 50 case studies dealing with a vast array of these different kinds of conditions of work and learning for different groups. So, employment conditions, essentially the findings are that we have in Canada a declining working class as traditionally understood, declining working class identity, and a growing professional employee class, speaking of the last 30 years in particular. Precarious work and job churning are increasing. Computer use is nearing universality. The majority of the labor force now require post-secondary credential to get a job. There are also general perceived increases since the 1980s in participation in job design and organizational decision-making roles amongst lower-level workers, that is to say service and industrial working class people. But there is little change for professional and managerial employees in terms of the extent of control they perceive themselves as having over job design and organizational decision making. Those are the basic stories on employment conditions. Learning conditions. We have in Canada the highest incidence of post-secondary completion in the world. University and community colleges combined, it's well over 60% of the current cohorts that are completing some form of post-secondary education. Further education course participation has increased correspondingly in conjunction with this increased formal education activity. There is also very extensive job-related and general informal learning. It's an iceberg image, if you will. Formal schooling and further education have increased in correspondence, as I mentioned, but informal learning has been very widespread throughout for people, regardless of their level of formal learning. And this occurs across the lifespan. All age groups are continually involved in informal learning. Older people don't stop. They decline marginally as they get very old, but still very active in informal learning as their participation in formal and further education drops like a rock. For good reason. As you're older, you're more experienced. I can tell the younger people in this room it does happen, at least a little. And employment classes vary greatly in formal education, less so in adult further education participation, and very little at all in their incidence of informal learning. Working class people are just as active in informal learning as professional and managerial class people. So let me just give a little detail on this. This is just an illustration of the changes in class structure. Just to give you one instance, in 1982, the industrial working class in Canada was 30% of the employed labor force. A couple of years ago, it had dropped to 18%. Service workers have also dropped. There's an image that service workers have increased, but no, they have dropped in terms of those people who do clerical sales work from a third of the labor force to less than a quarter. The groups that have increased are professional employees, that is to say, the traditional professional doctors and lawyers, teachers, engineers, and also computer programmers, and an array of technologists and technicians are also lumped in what I call the professional employee class. And managers from they've increased from 14% to 25%. It's a very substantial growth in that group of people who think of themselves as professional employees with specialized knowledge of some sort. And finally, managers have tripled from 4% in 1982 to 12% of the labor force in 2010. So an increasingly managed labor force, an increasingly professionalized labor force, and increasingly deindustrialized, de-working class labor force in traditional terms. Similarly, in terms of sense of working of class identity, industrial workers in particular, in their majority in 1982, believed themselves to be working class. They thought of themselves as a working class in relationship to exploiting or controlling employers. That proportion has both decreased in terms of its numbers and in terms of the proportion of the declining numbers who think of themselves as working class. So that's a condition that needs to be understood in terms of looking at the relationship between capital and labor in the contemporary term. It's not to say that the working class has become entirely depoliticized, but the diminishing features of consciousness. And here is another one, the notion of opposition to, that is to say, scabs, a crude way of saying whether or not there's support for the notion that management should be allowed to hire replacement workers when other workers are on legitimate strike. In 1982, 72% of industrial workers, the core, organized core of the working class, supported that proposition. No scabs. 2010, that sense had dropped to 57%. So a declining working class identity, a declining sense of oppositional working class consciousness are contextual features that we need to look at here in terms of general employment conditions. I mentioned job churning and precariousness already. I won't bore you with further points on that, but I will mention here that computer use in the Canadian working or labor force has astronomically increased. In 1989, 38% of Canadian workers used a computer in their jobs. 2010, 95%. Virtually everybody is now using a computer in some way. So the requirement for computer literacy has increased very, very substantially in this period. It's not like the use of the internet per se, but it's a very, very substantial incremental increase from under 40% to virtually everybody, much more than a double in this very short period of time. So please keep that one in mind. Design work, all or most of time. Here we've had an increase from 43% to 61% who believe they have a greater opportunity to design their work. And similar, self-reported role, supervisory role, 23% believe they had a supervisory role in 1982. Now 50% of wage and salary earners believe they have some degree of supervisory control. Everybody is now thinking they're a chief rather than Indian, apparently, to use that crude, hackneyed, racist notion. Excuse me for that. And one other important one that I'll just put on the table as a profile here. Post-secondary credential for entering a job. In 1982, 28% of the Canadian labor force required a post-secondary credential, either a university degree or a college diploma to get their job. By 2010, that had increased to 53%. So that's virtually a doubling of the requirement for job entry in post-secondary terms in this 30-year period. Again, these are very substantial increases in a relatively short period of time. So now we go to learning conditions. And here I'll just mention a few basic points again. First is the post-secondary educational attainment has gone from around 25% in 1982 to 64% in 2010. As I mentioned, nearly two-thirds of the Canadian labor force now has a post-secondary completion. And it is this increase in formal education participation has increased effectively in conjunction with or in correspondence with increasing participation in further education, the vast bulk of which is job related. Most of the further education that people take is related to some kind of job improvement or enhancement for reward purposes, which is precisely why when you leave employment, it drops off. Less and less people need further education of the job-related sense after they retire. And, again, to talk about informal learning, this is the iceberg. Virtually everybody participates in it. Most of my colleagues, sociologists, find this as a non-finding. Very boring. No variation. You need variation to explain things. Well, my basic point is that this iceberg is the foundation for everything else we do. We need to understand that lifelong learning is based on continuing informal learning. It's not based on engaging in a postdoctoral degree when you're 68, which is very nice and encouraging, but that is on the basis of the informal learning. It's all of this hidden part of the iceberg, which we all have. We need to understand that as a starting point for the knowledge society. Not necessarily the knowledge economy, but the knowledge society. We all have a continuing base of lifelong learning that's informal and intentional that informs and animates virtually everything else we do in learning and significantly in work, which I'll get to in a second. Not only do we spend the vast majority of our learning time in informal learning activities, but when we try to assess it or to estimate it, we find that, at least in asking Canadians, they will figure out when you give them any kind of an opportunity for an inventory that they're spending on average about 15 hours a week in intentional learning projects. We could go through this exercise with everybody in this room and we would find a range, quite a variation. Some people would be spending significantly less and some more, but the average, I think, for this room would probably be 15 to 20 hours. You can be skeptical about that, but if you go through the exercise, I think you'll be surprised. And this is some illustration of some of the activities. I just got an inventory here, podcasters, of the kinds of things that people do learn about informally related to their jobs. And with regard to age effect, we find, again, that virtually everybody is involved in informal learning through most of their lives. There's a drop once you get into your mid-70s in terms of the energy and motivation people have to engage in learning projects to some extent, but still over 80% of people who are in their post-75 period are engaged actively in informal learning. And on the other hand, if we look at the further education dynamic, it drops rapidly. So now, if we look at learning and work relations, let me start by suggesting that there are a number of different forms of relationship between learning and work, and I like to characterize them in terms of the notion of underemployment, the extent to which people's qualifications and knowledge is actually used in their job situation. And there are several different aspects of this. First, time-based, the most dramatic form of time-based underemployment is unemployment. That is total uselessness of your capacity. You're not allowed to engage in any form of meaningful work. I just saw a statistic today, 64% of Greek youth are unemployed. 64%. Involuntary time, temporary employment means you want to work much more than you can get of work. Compensated work. That is also a very significant feature. So both of these are time-based considerations. Knowledge-based or skill-based, we have what I would call the credential gap, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute, but it's the qualification you have, whether it's a post-secondary degree or a high school degree, is something that you are not able to utilize in your job. The job doesn't require that much qualification formally. Performance gap simply means that whatever you bring into the job in terms of formal qualifications, your capacities are not effectively utilized. They're underused because of the various constraints in the job. Relevance gap refers to the match between whatever kind of degree program or specialized qualifications you have and what you're able to use in the job you have. And the knowledge gap is the most general, meaning the overall knowledge and wisdom that you bring to the job is not fully utilized in the job. There's also the converse of all of these. That is to say, you can be underqualified for a job. The most common condition of underqualification is people who are older, who've been in the job, and the qualification has crept up behind them. In vast majority of those cases, they've learned through experience to do the job very well, thank you very much, but they're now underqualified. And finally, we have the subjective judgments, whether or not people feel underqualified and perceive themselves to be so. So those are the dimensions that I would argue are most important to consider in terms of the match between work and learning qualifications. And I'll just focus briefly on a few of these. Putting together the education requirements for job entry and the formal education requirements that people attain, we find that in 1982 in Canada, about roughly a quarter of the labor force had a post-secondary credential and roughly a quarter required one. So we had a rough equilibrium there in terms of requirements and attainments. By 2010, we have over 50% who required a post-secondary credential, and we have almost two-thirds who had obtained one. So we have credential inflation, if you will, or credential increase in terms of requirement, but people are keeping more and more ahead of it. So in this race, which I call the educational arms race, we have an increasing competition amongst employers to get the best qualified people. And amongst the labor force, we have an increasing effort to get more and more education to be able to compete for increasing number of qualified jobs. and the gap is increasing. Just to give you a couple of illustrations of that, credential underemployment increasing from 25% to over 30% in this period in terms of the number of people who have a match. If we look at this by employment class, we find that service workers and industrial workers are more underemployed in terms of their qualifications than professional and managerial workers. And that's basically because more and more people from working class backgrounds have accessed post-secondary education, come out with a degree, gone into the labor market, and not been able to find a commensurate job. Increasing numbers of people who are taking clerical jobs, for example, who have higher qualifications than are needed to perform those jobs. But it's also true that increasing numbers of managerial and professional employees are becoming underemployed as well. So a surplus of qualified workers for the jobs that are available is a growing condition in Canada, and I would submit to you throughout the advanced capitalist world, even in Malta. The other point I wanted to register here is the effect of time in this process of underqualification or underemployment. If you compare professional employees with industrial and service workers, you find that those industrial and service workers who have less than 10 years experience, over 40% of them are underemployed in their jobs. This is the phenomenon increasingly of the younger workers who come from working class background, get a post-secondary degree, and are unable to find a job that's commensurate with their qualifications. If they've been in the job for more than 10 years, 30% of them are still underemployed. That is to say, they have not been able to work through the problem. Capitalist labor relations are dynamic. There is a notion that the more time you spend in a job, the more experience you have with it, the more you're able to work it out, to make adaptations both to your knowledge base and to the job conditions so you can close that gap. Industrial and service workers have relatively minimal opportunity to close that gap. You compare that with professional employees under 10 years, 28% underemployed. If they've got over 10 years, this is close to roughly 10%. So there is an adaptation process, but it's working much more effectively for professional employees than it is for industrial and service workers. And finally, if we look at the overall situation, we find that the vast majority of wage and salary earners in the Canadian labor force recognize that there is a knowledge gap. That is to say, they have more effective and useful knowledge than they're able to utilize in their jobs. As I say, this seems to be a condition that is increasingly widespread in a variety of objective terms, and more people realize or perceive it to be a problem. Okay, let me end with computers, since I started with computers and the internet on the findings. We recall that graph of people increasingly using computers in their work, from 40% to 95% of the labor force. Just as we find in terms of the educational arms race generally, we find that with regard to computer requirements and computer literacy, people are again keeping ahead. So that according to basic estimates here, the majority of people now have higher computer skills than are needed in their jobs. This is counter to all the rhetoric we hear in much of the public media and certainly much of the argumentation that we see from business and government about the need for a more highly trained, more highly skilled labor force with skills of various sorts, and computer skills being one of the most centrally needed and under trained. And it's not true, according to the evidence that's available directly, in my view at least, from our studies. And this applies across employee classes. It applies across age groups. And finally, just a few notes about the case study findings. I mentioned there are over 50 of these we've been engaged in, and I will just give you a couple of words, which, I refer you to the website for much richer material. And the quote is from a tool setter on an auto assembly line. Just involve the people. This guy might run this machine every day for years. He will come up with ideas that will make his job easier for him and easier for management. Give people some sort of a sense of importance rather than being treated like cattle. That's a sentiment that we've heard over and over again from people who are in the conditions of underemployment, which, as I say, is a growing proportion of the Canadian labor force, and I would submit perhaps of labor forces throughout the advanced capitalist world. So what kind of alternatives can we identify? And I just want to briefly raise 2 points. The first is the principles that I would suggest should be operative in thinking about alternatives to work through this this contradictory situation. The first is the need to reconcile productive activity with the need to support future generations without compromising the ecosystem. Second is the right to a decent job, that is to make a living through work that permits a full use of human capabilities and dignity and security. Thirdly, participatory democracy, that is decisions should involve all who are engaged in production. And fourthly, equitable opportunities for those from all social backgrounds, economic class of origin, age, gender, race, or those with disabilities, to use their abilities. I would suggest that there are at least 3 basic kinds of alternatives that we can constructively be thinking about now. Without going into a lot of detail, briefly, shareholder capitalism, which is preeminent today throughout most of the neoliberal world. Stakeholder capitalism, which involves a considerably different profit sharing and co-determination factors. Economic democracy is the third option, which involves self-management, full employment, and other features economically. Just a couple of illustrations here about what we could be talking about in terms of job design and training alternative options. Paid work redistribution. We now have a situation where we have a growing numbers of people who are working 50-plus hours, long overtime jobs. Growing numbers of people who are working in temporary, part-time, involuntary, underemployed situation, particularly younger people. Possibility for partial phase retirements, older people, reduced hours for middle-aged people, and more younger people being given opportunities through mentorship and job sharing to be involved in more sustainable work on a longer term. Real democratized technical design and social authority, which would be beyond some of the perceptions of improvement that we just talked about. And then flexible scheduling responsive to work-lifetime balances. This relates particularly to the juggling of paid and unpaid work, men and women trying to work out paid and unwork schedules in more feasible ways. New forms of socially useful paid employment. This involves various kinds of sustainable products, renewing infrastructure, etc. And educational and training aspects that would involve both mentoring, as I've already alluded to, and prior learning assessment and recognition, which is to say, recognizing that this part of the learning process that's in the hidden part of the iceberg can be recognized and rewarded in much more effective ways, both by employers, by governments, and by workers themselves. If we reflect on what we learn and our competencies, and we engage in various kinds of assessment processes like portfolio development, demonstration projects, challenge exams, which can allow people's knowledge to be more effectively recognized and rewarded within workplaces. So those are a few specific kinds of examples that we might discuss more fully, but I'd now like to lead to my conclusions and open up for discussion. So the first point, in conclusion, is that educational systems should and likely will continue to try to improve the relevance of their programs in response to growing economic and social demands. Any of you who are educators in the room know that educators are continually trying to do that in their own microcosmic ways, at least. And professional training development personnel should make it a high priority to take steps to ascertain the current formal and informal skill knowledge profiles of those they provide formal training and development courses, rather than presuming that there are knowledge defects around them, as we hear continually rhetorically in the public media. We can anticipate that the educational arms race will continue, that educational qualifications formally may continue to be proxies for entry into many jobs. but economic production would be more effective and efficient if the current labor forces were more highly valued for their capabilities to develop and use reserves of abilities and decent jobs. I've already referred to the economic reforms, such as redistribution of paid work and workplace democratization, and that I think these would be more sustainable measures to address the systemic limits rather than corporate and government appeals for still greater learning efforts by already highly formally educated, knowledgeable, and continuing learning labor forces. So I think it's fair to say that we are living, as we always have, in a learning society, a knowledge society with increasingly widely informed citizens and workers, but that the notion of a knowledge-based economy remains a fragmentary illusion, at least until the underemployment and sheer waste of the talents of so many are recognized and addressed. I put on the board a, or on the slide, a reference to a few of the resources that are available, and most of these are notable through WAL Network. But finally, I would like to conclude by suggesting that the fundamental contradiction between profit-making, maximizing capitalist economy and the need for recognition and reward of the expanding knowledge of hired laborers remains much as it was in 1867 when Marx wrote Das Kapital. This contradiction is becoming clearly more globalized. Whatever temporary revolution or resettlement will depend on the extent to which the metabolic rift between profit-maximizing capitalist mode of production and sustainable ecosystem of Earth can be survived by Homo sapiens and other social species, including the 1,700 species of beetles in Malta, but also on the relation between the organized class forces grounded in the structured conditions that I profiled in the analysis that I've just given to you. In any case, Marx's analysis of the capitalist mode of production continues to provide a most insightful starting guide to understanding these contradictory relations that continue to shape our material conditions and our consciousness. We ignore Marx at our peril. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thanks, David, for wonderful overview of your research over the years and the situation between credentialing and jobs. Can I just ask one brief clarification? Your use of the term informal learning, are you using it in an all-embracing way? I mean, I'm probably, as you know, from my student days, I was exposed to the UNESCO classification between formal, non-formal, and informal. Are you incorporating non-formal within the informal?
Without getting too esoteric about this, I think non-formal is an illogical formulation that if we have a continuum of formal, organized activity, and informal, which is based on the kinds of spontaneous and situationally based learning activities that we engage in, then we can see all of our activities along that continuum. What we're doing here, for example, what is this? It's a kind of an organized activity. We're gathered together in a collective setting. It was scheduled somehow, and people congregated, and we're engaged in a kind of a dialogue. It's been monologuing so far, but I hope it will become dialogue. But that is somewhere along this continuum. The notion of non-formal has its own history, which was not thought of originally in terms of this continuum, but in terms of trying to distinguish a particular kind of education, part of which was a working class education, in relationship to the organized scholastic forms of education. So I would suggest we don't need it. I think there are many adherents to non-formal education, but I suggest it's an illogical way of thinking, and we can easily understand those activities as essentially kinds of a further education if they're in an organized context or if they're in a more spontaneous one as either a mentoring kind of informal education that you do. What you and I did was a kind of formal education. I was your supervisor. So that was in a formal schooling sense. There may have been other elements of that, of course, and we won't discuss that now, but we overlapped with other kinds of informal activities. But the basic point is you don't need non-formal, in my view, as a conception. But we do need to understand all of these four types of education or learning are overlapping and continually engaged in by most people in a learning society or a knowledge society.
I'll just open up with a couple of questions. The first is about your statistics and your various tables on the credential unemployment. That's formal credentials or informal credentials?
No, that's formal credentials. That's simply talking about the whether or not you have a post-secondary degree, a college diploma, a high school graduation diploma. Those are the three basics. And whether or not the job that you are in requires those either for entry or performance. So that's the tip of the iceberg again. It doesn't say much about the real knowledge that you bring. It's simply the credential. That's a starting point for analysis. And increasingly, as we do this tracing, the gap between the credential required and the credential achieved is increasing. And apparently the sense that people have of the knowledge that they bring and the knowledge that's required, that gap is also increasing, which again is corresponding to some extent to the credential, because we all live in a credential society and most people think about education and learning in terms of that particular indicator.
My only other question at this point is simply that could you expand perhaps by way of an example on the big iceberg, on the informal learning? You've given an example related to academics. Could you perhaps give an example related to, I don't know, industrial workers, where it's obviously a conviction of yours that there's a great deal of untapped knowledge?
Well, the first thing I'll do in self-serving character is to refer you to a book called Hidden Knowledge, which I and a colleague, Peter Sawchuk, published in 2004, which gives documentation of this in relationship to a whole array of working class settings. One of which, for example, is the Canadian Auto Workers Organization, their largest plant in Oshawa, Ontario, General Motors plant, produces with over 22,000 workers. and there's a situation where organized laborers have negotiated with their employer from a condition of strength to ensure continuing education provision. In fact, an auto worker who has qualified with 10 years experience can use it, according to the paid educational leave program, to take a degree in museum studies. Now, with the increasing conditions of recession, of the decline of the auto industry in North America, that's becoming an increasingly delicate situation. It's still there on the books now. Fewer and fewer people are utilizing it because they have less and less motivation to get a degree in museum studies when they're trying to keep hand and mouth together. But secondly, that relates to a whole array of other activities that people are involved in informally amongst themselves in the plant. The major form of informal learning that occurs in virtually every workplace is informal job training by more experienced people training other workers. A lot of that is incidental. A lot of it is presumed by employers. It's not rewarded or recognized, but it's expected that the more experienced worker will teach, train, guide the less experienced worker. You all have experienced it, and if you've been the mentor in that process, you've probably not gotten any real recognition for it.
Hello. We've been hearing a lot about terms like globalization, knowledge economy, knowledge society, but to be perfectly honest with you, I'm still uncertain what is meant by knowledge economy. I presume that there are certain characteristics which define a knowledge economy, like the free movement of capital, for example, which is a fundamental issue, the exploitation of resources from one country to another. But there's still a lot of doubts about the free movement of people from one country to another. Mm-hmm. For example, presently in the United States, one of the hottest issues is what to do with immigrant workers. So How would you define the immigration trends in the context of the knowledge economy? That's one question. I've got another one, if you don't mind. In the last section, section 3, you mentioned the relationships that exist between working and learning. One of the concepts which has come out from this relationship is the concept of employability. If, for example, you look at the definition of employability by the Conference Board of Canada, you see words like adaptability, flexibility, willingness to change, willingness to retrain. What's the role of formal education in the concept of employability? Thank you.
Okay. Well, the short answer to the question is that what you've described is not distinctive at all to the current moment. These are features of the capitalist economy for memory of all our lives. That free movement of capital, for example, has been something that has been a primary goal of capitalists from the outset. The free trade agreements that have occurred throughout the world, Canada's actively involved in seeking more and more of them as I speak, have as a motivation to ensure that Canadian capitalists, Canadian corporations are going to have a wider market for their goods, whether it that happens to be well, any of our staples. The most infamous one right now is our tar sands oil, which is a very controversial issue in Canada. But the notion of free flow of capital is a sine qua non for the capitalist economy to maximize its profits. As far as the free flow of labor is concerned, there are various limitations on that, but globalization means that there is an increasing motivation from the point of view of capital to find adept and competent labor wherever it can for the cheapest cost. And so that means capital will go where labor is. Not necessarily, or very rarely, less so that labor will come wherever it wants or wherever it can. It's that essentially that capital will flow to the cheapest labor pool. And that's the condition we're facing around the world today. But those conditions are no different in principle than they have been for generations. I dare say since the beginning of the capitalist mode of production, what's happened is become more globalized. The relationships have become more evident on a widespread rather than individual country basis. As far as employability per se is concerned, again, we have an array of qualifications that employers are putting out as necessary for an adequate labor force in the advanced knowledge economy. Call it what you will, the basic motivation from the point of view of employers is always to try and encourage workers to become more well-trained for the jobs that are available. If you asked employers in 1950 whether there was a deficit in terms of the skill level of the employee body, and whether you asked them today, you'd get the same answer. There's a deficit. There aren't enough adequately qualified workers. More and more workers have to become more and more prepared for the jobs that we're prepared to offer them. That's the logic of capital. From the point of view of workers, whether it's adaptability, flexibility, or literacy, or any other array of skills, the objective is to find a modicum of decent work to allow you to realize a subsistence, to survive adequately. So workers' motivations in this context are increasingly compelled to gain more and more of whatever the employers, the governments are asking them to do. And they're doing that very well, thank you very much, and not getting adequate compensation for it. That's the story that we found throughout, and it's becoming more graphically gap-like because of the dynamic that I just described in these statistics. More and more people are gaining more and more knowledge for less and less adequate work. I think that's fair to say generally, but again, I'm hesitant to say anything about Malta, because I do not know your condition, except to say, and I will add one specific fact from the statistics that are available to me in the European Union, it appears that Malta is in the middle of the pack. That is to say, whereas Canada is rated as a high underemployment country, Malta is a middle-range underemployment country. It's on average. In terms of one particular figure that I've looked at recently, Canada is up with Romania at about 50% underemployment on some criteria. Malta's at 33%, 32% is the EU average, and down at the bottom we have a few other countries that remain nameless for the moment.
Okay, you referred to the Greek situation where you have 64% of Greek youth unemployed. So yeah. We're speaking in terms of massive unemployment and massive underemployment, and yet no revolution and no major upheaval.
I have to correct you on that, really. I don't pretend to be an expert on Greece, but I do know from the reports that I've heard from Professor Sotirios of University of the Aegean and others that there is substantial upheaval in Greece. A lot of it is at a micro level. We're not talking here about Syriza and the electoral dynamic, but what's happening on the ground. It's not simply popular demonstrations and protests, of which there are multitudes. It's the various kinds of organizing activities that are occurring on the ground in local areas, and apparently there are very substantial ones. You don't hear about those in the dominant media, but this is the kind of reorganization and resistance that is occurring on the ground. And if we have a condition where two-thirds of young people are unemployed, there's got to be some kind of engagement with alternatives. But again, I am not an expert in this field. I simply suggest that there appear to be some things going on the ground that we're not hearing about in the mainstream media.
Yes, there are movements, but there's no major, what I mean, major confrontation with the state. That's what I mean by a revolutionary situation, not an upheaval here and there. So in terms of my corollary question would be, in this situation where it is very apparent that capitalism is basically has been normalized globally and it's hegemonic in nature, do you agree with that?
It's hegemonic at the moment, but hegemony is always a moving target.
Yes,
resettlement, settlement, unsettlement, yes.
Yeah, but we know that capitalism is very resilient. It has been challenged and it has gone through major difficulties in the past with the tiger economies, etc.
Yes, and
I
would say
has this ability to reorganize itself.
Yes, and I would say one other important point here, and that is that, and this is the subject of a piece of research that I'm working on now, the rise and fall of economic classes, that the capitalist class in the world today, and in Canada in particular, is highly coherent, both in terms of its consciousness, its political networking, and its strategies for reproduction in many different economic and political ways. The working class in Canada is fairly disorganized at this point. You saw the graphs that I showed you about the declining organized industrial working class, declining working class consciousness. These are features of the moment. What I'm suggesting is that whether we have the Greek situation, which I see as one of the most extreme at this point, or whether we have the more middling situations of your country and mine, there are relationships that are very dynamic and continually changing, and we need to be careful about making presumptions about the necessity of a particular kind of a power relationship as being eternal or non-negotiable.
So, given the empirical evidence on the ground, what kind of world are you visualizing that would allow for your personal vision there, personal transformative vision?
What I'm envisaging, what I'm hoping for, is with the optimism of the will that I can muster here, is that as the professional employees group that I referred to, with specialized knowledge, become increasingly challenged by the job structure and increasingly discouraged by the conditions that they're able to realize, including people in this room, for example, and the students who are coming through your programs, who have expectations and aspirations that they're going to get decent jobs with the specialized qualifications that they come out in the labor market with. They come out, they discover they can only get temporary part-time jobs, they get discouraged, and they go into various kinds of coping strategies. The pattern so far, and I speak specifically of underemployment as a phenomenon from the 1960s onward, is that more and more people have become underemployed, more and more people have taken the pragmatic acceptance route to gain more qualifications so that they individually have a better chance in a more competitive job market. At some point, this strategy has diminishing marginal returns, if we can use the economist notion. In Greece, when we have two-thirds of the youth population unemployed, it has reached the end of diminishing returns, in my view. Something else has to replace it. And what is replacing it on the ground now is a variety of microcosmic actions that may or may not result in the kind of larger collective movement that I hope for. I don't guarantee it, but I think it's a possibility as we speak.
The reaction in Greece can go either way, either extremes.
Yes.
As Sotiris will say, in fact.
Yes.
Well, the last elections showed it, yes. the two small parties.
Just pushing the discussion forward a bit, David. I mean, I think your whole idea of a contradiction between knowledge and use of knowledge in the capitalist economy plays upon Marx's growing dialectic between the social forces and the social relations of production. You seem to be suggesting that the mode itself is generating a social force of and for knowledge which it cannot accommodate given its structure. But one could just perhaps argue the other way around, couldn't one? One could say that, I mean, in terms of your definitions, capitalism is promoting all of this knowledge at a speed of change, including your first statistic about the jump in internet use from 60 million to 3 billion. It's promoting all this, and it's hard for the real economy to keep up with the kind of knowledge explosion that's taking place. You see, in other words, you're putting in terms of an irresolvable gap, which you present as a problem, mm-hmm. given the Marxian dialectic mm-hmm. between forces and relations production. Mm-hmm. But arguably, other people would say, hey, there's a growing explosion of internet and managerial and all kinds of knowledge. And it's a sign of the success of the system. You mm-hmm. see, you understand the,
yeah, sure.
the difference in approach or perspective.
I'm not sure it's a question, it's more an observation. I see a lot of what's happening is a car crash at the moment, I'm afraid. Because, I mean, you're talking about the knowledge society, okay, we're fast getting to a stage where the various Facebooks and Googles of this world are obsessed with big data and social profiling, and they are using that data for their own profit. Okay, so even though the citizens are obsessed with horizontal knowledge exchange, and as a result, yes, we are more empowered, it is still for the profit of the very few. The other thing I haven't heard about is institutionalized education and the crisis of institutionalized education. Yes, in the old days you could go and get a PhD and go to university, but now you can also go to lindonlinda.com and get a course for $5. And that's what a lot of people are starting to do, because a lot of people are saying it's not worth my while investing in a master's program because I'm not going to find a job. And I'm also concerned about initiatives like Coursera, for instance, where you have the blue chip universities that are starting to, that can afford to start giving away some of their courses for free to retain the brands. And I think you're going to find some red brick universities that are going to be in a crisis because they can't really afford it. Look at what's happening in England. Okay, and I'm seeing the beneficiaries being even University of Malta, getting UK students coming to study in Malta because it's cheaper. So I'm seeing the car crash at the moment. I can't see the solution. So
well, that's where to take Paul's point, it could not necessarily be a car crash. One scenario that is feasible, it's conceivable, is that the explosion of knowledge, the socialization of knowledge, will continue apace so that virtually everybody in the world, including the poorest people in India, have access to a laptop. There's initiatives of that sort right now. So that the knowledge explosion continues. More and more people have more and more effective, usable knowledge at their fingertips. This means that with globalized capitalist transnational corporations controlling meaningful compensated work, that more and more people will be acquiring more and more knowledge to qualify for, to compete for those jobs, and we will have a knowledge economy of the sort that is being projected by the corporate world. We have more and more people who are pursuing sufficient knowledge that there will always be a surplus, but there'll be enough for us to organize profit-making activities, whatever the new commodities be. And if you just think, in my lifetime, I've gone from television, which when I was a kid really became available for the first time. I remember watching the first television set in our community, to VCRs, which became an intervening commodity between me and the television set, to the whole array of electronic devices today, which bewilder me. I mean, I don't do Twitter and Facebook, but I realize that that is a whole array of new stuff that's in there that's being sold to us by a whole new set of transnational corporations. And young people today are being born into that world, taking it as normal that they're going to engage and acquire knowledge through that, and maybe, if they acquire enough of it, get some kind of a temporary job. That's a scenario that is emerging under our feet right now. I don't deny the possibility. I simply suggest that there are better possibilities if we want to have decent compensated work to allow us to utilize our really effective knowledge. And I suggested some of the alternatives here, but they're simply ideas unless we have political forces that are going to mobilize and act in demand for realization. And that is the fundamental political question. We are all engaged in that, and whether or not we opt to make a concrete decision on it, we are effectively implicated. We need to make some decision, and the whole point of this is to make informed decisions, to situate yourself. Which side are you on, and what are you going to fight for? And that's all I'm really trying to say. We have choices to make here, and they are significant for the future of our children and our ecosystem.
It's an observation as well that I'd like to make, and I've got progressively sicker since I've been in this room, so I'm hoping my brain's functioning properly. I'm hoping I'm making sense. It's related to the comment earlier about migrant workers. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but when you speak of underemployment, you're speaking of underemployment of workers with a formal education. And I just want to inject another aspect. You said that capital moves to labor. And certainly we can look at, I mean, just the tragedy that happened in India as an example of that. But labor is also moving to capital, yep, as well. And we're seeing that in the migrant flows from the global south, who do not, many of them do not have a degree of formal of education. Mm-hmm. And they are simultaneously filling these low-skilled jobs that those with a formal education no longer want to do. And as you were talking, I just became aware, it's just an observation, a paradox, if you like, that the educational response has been to provide these unskilled workers with education, to sort of just bring them into this vicious cycle, basically. And it was just something that you made me aware of now.
That's a very good point. And I think, again, in terms of the global vision here, I'm talking to you from the standpoint of an advanced capitalist society. If we look at immigrant workers from the underdeveloped world, many of them are moving, if the opportunity is available, to the developed world where they perceive better living conditions, more affluence, and opportunities for themselves. Immigration has always been in pursuit of some kind of opportunity. My father moved from Ireland in pursuit of opportunity in North America. So when we talk about Greece and 64% youth unemployment, how is Greece operating its economy? I submit to you that part of that is based on immigrant workers who are doing the dirty jobs for cheap wages on the basis of very low or no qualifications because the Greeks don't want to do them. That's part of the reality of the reproduction of global capitalism. And so I think it's extremely important to recognize the global condition of labor, not simply the condition of highly qualified workers in the most advanced capitalist economy. As I said, Canada's got the highest level of qualification. And we have a substantial immigrant labor force that's maintaining and reproducing the dirty jobs at the bottom, or else the whole thing would fall apart. So how many dirty jobs do there have to be? And how many people have to resist before the system does begin to disintegrate? That's part of the question as well.
Well, I just changing the topic slightly to what you said at the very beginning, I thought it was fascinating that the top five corporations were all financial. Mm-hmm. And many more, you said, if you 50, look through the 50, a lot of them will be financial. And that reminds me of a book which has recently come out by the bad boy of Anglo-American anthropology, David Graeber, 2011, called Debt, The First 5,000 Years, in which he looks at different types of credit and debt alternating over 5,000 years up to the present. And he says that actually the capitalist system is better defined as a banking system than the strict Marxian definition, which tended to emphasize an industrial system which pumps surplus value out of manufacturing laborers. If you look at all the transitions over time, beginning with the 1450s, 1490s expansion to the Americas, financed by Genoese capital, and then all the gains from the gold going to Dutch capital, he said from the beginning it's really been a banking system more than an industrial system. And secondly, if you look at the spread of the labor force, it's always been based more on slave labor and various forms of semi-free labor than it has been based on wage labor. And the end of this entire process which you're presenting is that indeed, it's money and the growth of money which defines change as opposed to any more technological process.
Well, this is the beginning of a very long dialogue and debate, I think. But let me just say a couple of things very briefly in conclusion. And the first of which is, in terms of the relevance of Marx, which is the label for this series, Marx wrote his work in the very formative period of industrial capitalism, machinofacture, when the factory system was becoming widely generalized. And so his particular focus was on the extraction of labor power from industrial workers. He didn't deny the extraction of labor power and profit making from other workers as well. He used examples about teachers, for instance, in private schools, and the profit making that was done by the private owners of those schools. But today we're in a system where, as I mentioned at the outset, it's not material goods that are central to the exploitative labor's condition. It's information service work. And in that process, it's centrally the activities that are involved in the financial sector that are organizing the system. And it's that system, that sector of the system from which the major profit maximization occurs. There are hedge fund managers today, as many of you probably know, who are making billions, I say billions of dollars a year. And this is the top of the system, the extraction of surplus value from all those people below it who are making various material goods on the one hand, who are providing various kinds of financial and personal and clerical services on the other hand, including derivatives. So in that sense, to take your point, debt features and mercantile primitive accumulation elements have always been part of the capitalist system. It's now a globalized system. It's now centrally controlled, as Vitaly's work demonstrates in that graph that I showed you. The financial corporations that dominate, that control and rule this system in fundamental ways. And it's inconceivable that it will be overthrown unless financial capital relationship becomes challenged and overturned in some ways. And one particular instance of that I just leave you with is People's Banks. North Dakota is the only state in the United States that has a state bank, a public bank. They're not part of the Federal Reserve System. Very few people realize that. But they have been able to manage their state affairs in that particular area, partly through that set of cooperative arrangements on a local basis. And there are all sorts of other instances of People's Banks, Grameen, etc., which are engaged in trying to develop the resources within communities for the use of those communities themselves. And this is totally contradictory to the relationship with big banks. In my country, five banks rule the reality for most people. But on the other hand, we have a cooperative movement co-op credit unions and a whole array of communitarian economies that are self-sustaining, self-sufficient, and growing. And on that note of optimism, I think I will end. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled The Fundamental Contradiction Between the Knowledge Society and the Knowledge Economy. This talk was delivered by Professor David Livingstone.